From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
My understanding is that the State Department is actually still reviewing their letter to determine exactly what the request is and what is motivating that request.
That was White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest at his daily press conference Tuesday, addressing questions from the press about reports Monday that the developer of the proposed Keystone XL pipeline had submitted a letter to the U.S. State Department asking that it suspend its review of the project until after next year's election.
I think we have all shared our collective view, and I think this is one of the situations where we have a collective view, that this is a process that has taken an extensive amount of time to complete. I don't have an update for you in terms of where the State Department currently is in the process, but given how long it's taken, it seems unusual to me to suggest that somehow it should be paused yet again.
Earnest admitted that the project has been a highly charged political issue. Nevertheless, he said he did not believe that the president planned to suspend the review for next year's elections.
The election is a year away. I believe exactly a year away. I don't think that that's a good excuse for basically spending the next year doing nothing.
And we will keep you updated on this story as it develops.
One in 10 cases involving the killing of journalists is resolved, which in fact equals almost complete impunity for perpetrators.
That was Catherine Bora, permanent representative of Greece to the UN, speaking at UN headquarters in New York Monday to mark an international day to end impunity for crimes against journalists.
Impunity doesn't thrive only in situations of armed conflict, but also where there is lack of political commitment. States should be ready not only to condemn, but also to put the existing mechanisms into practice.
As if to show the world a working definition of impunity against journalists, and almost on cue, Turkey's government conducted massive arrests of opposition journalists across the country Tuesday and implemented a purge of dissidents from some outlets. Turkey is the international poster child for the repression of journalists, with more journalists in its prisons than any other country in the world. On Tuesday, two editors of a leftist Turkish magazine were arrested in Istanbul for publishing a controversial cover story. A tweet from Nokta magazine read simply, quote, "Nokta editor-in-chief and managing editor were arrested on charges of attempting to overthrow the government by force," closed quote. Meanwhile, on the same day, 58 opposition journalists were fired and 57 more arrested on charges of being a terror group. On Tuesday, 58 journalists working for Koza İpek were denied entry to their offices, which had been sealed by police, and told that their contracts were terminated. The government said it was taking over management of the broadcasters. In the western city of Izmir, 57 people were arrested in dawn raids, alleged to be part of a terror group affiliated with Fethullah Gulen, a Sunni preacher who was once a close ally of Turkey's president, but who has since fallen out of favor. It was not specified what illegal activities they were allegedly engaged in. In an earlier crackdown, riot police interrupted a live broadcast last week as they broke into the offices of TV channels owned by Koza İpek, who was also reportedly linked to Gulen. In the U.S., there appeared to be a perception on Capitol Hill Tuesday that there was a different kind of threat relating to journalism, this one not being a threat to journalists, but a threat from them to U.S. national security. A Senate committee spent 2 hours Tuesday doing what Senate committees seem to do best, discussing the supposed threat posed by Russia. But this time it wasn't a threat from the military they were focused on. It was the supposed danger to the U.S. posed by Russian media. In particular, the alleged threat posed by RT was prominently featured at that hearing. The hearing of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee was opened by Democratic Senator Jean Shaheen from New Hampshire.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a statement that I will enter for the record, but let me just point out that I've been to Europe several times over the last 4 or 5 months, and both Eastern Europe, Ukraine, and the Baltics. And one of the things that I heard everywhere I went was the impact of Russian propaganda in those countries. And I think it's important for us not to lose sight of the ways that the Kremlin has been able to use its state-owned media to harass journalists for disinformation and to create space for Putin's recklessness abroad. I think it's important for us to look at ways that we can leverage opportunities offered by new media technologies, by the insight and assistance of our European allies, to create opportunities for Russians, for Ukrainians, and for all of those people who have been within Eastern Europe to access accurate information and make their own informed decisions. I had the opportunity earlier this year to present an Atlantic Council Freedom Award posthumously to Boris Nemtsov. As we all know, he has had been tireless in promoting freedom and openness in Russia. And I remember I presented the award to his daughter, and I think she very aptly summarized the threat posed by Russian propaganda. She said, "Russian propaganda kills. It not only kills reason and common sense, it literally kills." And that, I think, was a very important statement for us to remember today at this hearing and as we look going forward at how to combat that propaganda.
RT's Gayan Chichikayan has more.
Having watched the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee hearing titled "Putin's Invasion of Ukraine and the Propaganda That Threatens Europe," we at RT have learned something new about ourselves.
Just to be on the safe side, though, RT, which does not broadcast in Russian, never identifies itself as a Russia-based and government-funded network.
The fact that RT is Russia-based is in its name, which stands for Russia Today. Not so obvious to Leon Aaron, a member of the BBG, organization that runs U.S. government-funded media, including Radio Free Europe and Voice of America. From him, we also learned this about RT.
RT is hardly these all-powerful, seductive monster. Credible polling that was done in Western Europe, they barely registered. Very negligible. Russia Today is not all-powerful at all. You know, RT is a glamour project.
Interesting perspective, if not confusing, considering a good part of the hearing was dedicated to how the U.S. should counter RT.
Time and talent and task and risk-taking innovation and, yes, money for U.S. international media will continue to be needed to counter this effort.
Obviously, Radio Free Europe, Voice of America, these things are very strong in the Cold War. On a scale of 1 to 10, let's say 10 is the most effective. Let's say that's our countermeasures that we were employing in the Cold War. How low did it go and where are we at right now?
I think we're at a 3 or 4.
RT at 10 right now?
I don't overgive them, but I would say they are a 7 to 8.
Pretty darn good. How low did we go?
We have a long way to climb before we can be as omnipresent as Russian influence is today.
An expert on digital media said this about RT.
We tweet, but we tweet to send long press releases to someone that, quite frankly, no one really cares about. And we send out YouTube videos that put us to sleep, whereas Russia today, in fact, is able to claim to have more than 2 billion viewers as the largest network, Russian news network, online. So we have to transform the way you communicate in that space, otherwise we're gonna lose the battle.
Overall, it was a somewhat Cold War-style hearing, with the main undercurrent being us versus them. In Washington, I'm Ganesh Chekyan, RT.
Mixed signals for Beijing from Washington. A report Wednesday morning from Reuters that U.S. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter and his Malaysian counterpart will be aboard the USS Theodore Roosevelt Thursday on a cruise likely to highlight, if not further inflame, tensions with China over its territorial claims in the South China Sea. That report followed by a meeting between senior officials of China's military and the commander of the U.S. Pacific Command, Harry Harris, in Beijing, a meeting which many believed was aimed at de-escalating tensions over those issues, although China's Ministry of National Defense said the official visit was a long-scheduled event, part of an ongoing effort to expand trust and enhance transparency between the militaries of the two nations. CCTV's Han Bin has more.
This meeting, arranged well in advance, comes after an incursion in the South China Sea. Last week, the USS Destroyer Lesser patrolled off China's Nansha Islands. China calls the unannounced military maneuver a serious provocation.
I had planned to have a good discussion with you on the South China Sea. However, despite China's solemn representation, the U.S. sent a warship to patrol the area, creating a disharmonious atmosphere.
The U.S. says it was exercising freedom of navigation and rejects China's claims. Though compromise is hard, both acknowledge that direct dialogue is crucial to crisis management, and high-level exchanges represent mutual interest in resolving conflicts through dialogue.
Harrier's visit is the first senior U.S. official after the lesser patrol in the South China Sea. Both sides are using this occasion to make their positions clear. It's a test of their relationship. Whether this visit helps put out fire or add more fuel depends on the U.S. next military maneuver in this region. Hanbin, CCTV from the National Defense in Beijing.
Meanwhile, differences over the South China Sea led countries from Southeast Asia, along with China and the U.S., to cancel a joint statement at a meeting of defense ministers in Malaysia Wednesday. China's defense ministry confirmed that the meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, had failed to conclude a joint declaration, blaming, quote, the individual country from out of the region, closed quote, implying, without naming the United States, as the main reason for the breakdown in the discussions. Meanwhile, as the U.S. thumps its chest in the South China Sea and discusses the threat from Russian media in Washington, China has been very busily engaged in reconfiguring the economic realities in Asia. For the first time in 3 years, leaders from China, Japan, and South Korea met for trilateral talks. South Korea's President Park Geun-hye hailed it as a complete restoration of the relationship between the two countries. The following studio discussion, hosted by CCTV's Tian Wei, presents a look at the views of all three sides of what's always been a rather complex relationship.
The trilateral relations among China, Japan, and South Korea. We are joined here in our Beijing studio, Mr. Yang Xiyu, senior fellow at the China Institute of International Studies. Welcome, sir. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., from the United States, we are having Ms. Yu Jiang Lim, who is a lecturer of Korean studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. She's originally coming from South Korea. Meanwhile, in Tokyo, Japan, we have Mr. Takaaki Asano, research fellow at the Tokyo Foundation. Welcome to our program. The three of you representing three sides. I hope we're going to have a very interesting discussion. First of all, the South Korean president, Ms. Park Geun-hye, made this statement. She used one specific phrase, which is complete restoration of the relations among the three countries. Before I go to the Chinese guest, let me ask you, Ms. Lim, is that too much exaggeration?
I think I do understand your somewhat skepticism about the this specific wording, but I do think her that specific remark is from the efforts to the shed a light on the fact that, I mean, that this very important trilateral summit has been restored or restarted. Again, as we all know, it has been frozen since the last time in May 2012, and even the bilateral summit, between the Seoul and the Tokyo has been frozen for the last few years. So this very important dialogue, dialogue channel. So that, I think, this specific fact per se is more than just meaningful.
I see. It seems there are some Northeast Asian typical politeness is in that specific phrase, I guess. Let me go to you, Mr. Asano. You are also smiling at this moment. About South Korea and Japan, I have to mention history issues because that's what has been hindering the relations for so long. Comfort women. Let me just quote the two leaders from two countries. From President Park of South Korea, she talked about Japan should, quote, heal the painful history, end of quote. And yet your Prime Minister, Mr. Abe, talked about to South Koreans saying, quote, look to the future, end of quote. It seems that people are looking at very two different directions, not only from the two remarks coming from the two state leaders. What do you think? Are really South Koreans and the Japanese seeing eye to eye now on history issues, or we just temporarily forget about the history issue, at least for 2 days, before we move on it again?
You're right. Has the trilateral relations or the bilateral relations between Japan and South Korea, as you just pointed out, has been completely restored? I don't think so. It remains to be seen at the least. But at the same time, the document that was released, it's a diplomatic document. It's a well-crafted document. President Park could go back to Seoul, her constituency and claim that she has warned Japan that all the cooperation would be contingent on the Japan square facing up to history. And of course, for Mr. Abe, he could go back to Tokyo and claim that the three countries have agreed on the future-oriented relations. So, I mean, it's a diplomatic document. And in terms of the confident woman issue, yes, it's very difficult. Japanese government's position is that it has totally been legally, everything is settled. And it remains to be seen.
Right. Ms. Lim, I have to go back to you before I once again go to the Chinese guys, because this is something very emotional for South Koreans. Internally, for your political scenes, it is extremely important. So what do you... All right, it seems that we have been losing some signals coming from Washington. Let me go to you, Mr. Yang, here in Beijing. Mm-hmm. History issue also exists between China and Japan. For the South Koreans, comfort women seem to be the one that's on the priority of history issues. Mm-hmm. For China, there has also been a lot of these grievances about the Second World War that still mm-hmm. have not been settled. And if I could just clearly point it out, sir, mm-hmm. the past 3 years, the reason the trilateral meeting has been postponed mm-hmm. or halted has a lot to do with the Abe administration's attitude toward history, yep. of course, with China also sovereignty as well. Mm-hmm. So do you think a trilateral meeting like this for 2 days will be able to solve any problem?
No, I think this is at most a good start to solve all issues we mentioned. Basically, this meeting produced nothing but producing a good atmosphere and a good framework for the three countries to deal with the differences as well as seek for the common interests. So in other words, I don't think the bilateral relation, individual bilateral relation and the trilateral relation has been restored to the previous level. Only achievement is the three leaders determined to resume the previous level. That's why I said it's a good start.
To what extent do you think, Mr. Yang, the leaders' quote-unquote decision, given their estimation of the internal politics mm-hmm. and also the forces coming from outside for South Korea and Japan, probably it's more about the United States than anything else, mm-hmm. will be able to turn the trend or turn the waves of bilateral or trilateral relations?
You touch on a very key term, say, internal politics. So even the individual top leaders from any of the three countries have the determination or willingness to improve substantively the bilateral and the trilateral relation, but the domestic politics is too huge to create such changes by the top leader. So in other words, behind every top leader, the every individual internal politics restrains the agreement or solution on the historical disputes among the three countries, mainly between China, South Korea, and Japan.
Mr. Arsenault, we all understand in your country, next year, parliamentary election, and also it is a time when Mr. Abe has to see whether his political status can be maintained or not. Will this meeting, though, the trilateral meeting, for whatever purpose it is, whatever its achievement could be, a huge political gain for Mr. Abe to go back and claim to the Japanese voters and say, see what I have achieved. I not only convinced the internally to revise of the constitution, which the new neighbors got irritated, but they still got to talk to me.
I don't know how huge the political gain is for Mr. Abe, but it is a plus. It's definitely. And all those active diplomacy of Mr. Abe since he, for the second time, came into office at the end of 2012, this Abe diplomacy would not be complete with, without mending ties with our two closest neighbors. And yes, he could stress to his constituency in Tokyo that the, despite the, not revision, the reinterpretation of the constitution and passing of those security bills, still he's able to, he was able to talk with two leaders.
Mr. Yang in Beijing, for a while, you could hear commentators coming from South Korea and China talking about if Prime Minister Abe does not go, it is impossible for the countries to restore their relations. It is also impossible for the three countries to come back to its original track, talking about common destination in Northeast Asia. So, what about this meeting? Isn't this meeting is giving more political capital for Mr. Abe to stay in the office? And will that mean necessarily in the future a continuation, probably an acceleration of the speed of some of the political agendas Mr. Abe have in mind?
Well, this trilateral summit meeting can provide some media effects domestically for Japan, for Abe, periodically. But in the long run, the results of the trilateral meeting provide very little for Abe, for their political capital, simply because without the further progresses on historical issues and other dispute controversial issues, no any other substantive economic cooperation can be achieved. Then the public in Japan will see, oh, that was all they had, nothing substantive. So I don't think without the following progress, this trilateral meeting will provide any effective political capital for Abe administration.
I see. Now I see Ms. Lim is coming back to our big screen. Welcome back, Ms. Lim. We miss you very much. Let me ask you about another direction, the trade. Of course, the three countries are very pragmatic countries. They come back for a common cause. The cause is the trade. Bilateral already free trade agreement between China and South Korea. Trilateral, three countries were working on it back in the year 2012. But how much possibility is there? Will these historical grievances still be the precondition for the three countries to work on something more concrete, such as the trade? But without creating the right atmosphere, it's very hard to convince the domestic constituency that the trade, particularly trilateral trade agreement, should go ahead.
Okay.
First and foremost, the recent agreement on the TPP, I think it gives a kind of a very positive stimulus to further progress of trilateral economic cooperation or a more regional economic cooperation, such as RCEP. And the second, you pointed out, you know, some of that kind of, you know, historical controversies might hinder the further economic cooperation among the regional countries. Of course, I do understand your concern or the general concerns about, you know, the kind of bad spillover effects of the historical issues to another one. But it looks like, again, the South Korean government now to change the directions from more synthesized one to the two so-called two-track. Again, which means they'll not try to segregate the historical issues and the economic cooperation. As long as a strong demands or desires for the further economic cooperation is there in the reality, I do think further progress of more positive progress can be done in the near future.
It is not just the historical issues, Mr. Yang, here in Beijing. Mm-hmm. It is also sovereignty issues. Both South Korea and China had disputes concerning sovereignty, territorial integrity with Japan. Some of the islands are still, you know, up for debate. And so can we put really all of these issues aside and work on the trade? Of course, trade is going to be very significant for the future of this region, but still, can they exist as if there's no other factors that would ever influence its events?
Well, to some degree, the three countries can de-link the trade issue with the controversial and the sensitive issues like historical and sovereignty on the island. However, fundamentally, both of the controversial issue, sovereignty on islands and the historical issue, is an inevitable factor affecting the even trading cooperation among three. The past 3 years has provided very hard evidence to show how negative effects the political issue can impede the better cooperation among the three. So basically, on one hand, we need to seek for better cooperation on trade, but on the other hand, we cannot completely set aside the political issues.
Right.
Like forget about history, just focus on the future. Because our shared future, based on the shared history, we cannot divide completely between the two.
All right. Before we go, Mr. Arsenal, this is an important question. Can the creation of mechanisms, which the three countries are trying to do during this round of trilateral meeting, really be able to make up for the lack of contents or agreements of content among the three countries? That's the ultimate question I think that needs to be asked. Mr. Asano.
Well, I wouldn't say the document that was released totally lacks content. And it addresses a lot of practical issues that need to be addressed. And that's very important. And I think the biggest issue for the three leaders or the three governments is not stop holding these summits. They have agreed to hold the annual summit, the trilateral summit annually. The most important thing is not stop doing it. Short of war, the three leaders should continue meeting, whatever happens.
All right. Ms. Lim, one sentence before we wrap up.
Yes. Oh, again, resuming this important dialogues among the key East Asian countries, that specific fact per se is, I do think, is historically meaningful. Of course, this specific summit cannot satisfy everybody completely, but at the same time, this provides a kind of huge progress for the future development.
Mr. Yang, as optimistic as that?
Mm-hmm.
cautious optimistic because, as I said, following up progress on the political issues can input new momentum for the better cooperation that will create greater common interest for all of our three.
All right. Yang Xiyu here in Beijing. Yu Jung Lim in Washington, D.C., originally from South Korea, and Takasaka Asano in Japan, Tokyo. Thank you so much for being with us, the three of you. Thank you very much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.